We do seem to be tapped into the truth frequency, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm so glad to see other researchers coming to the same conclusions that we've drawn independently, because the hoax has been so obvious, but the agenda is still hidden in some people's eyes. And that's why we have to get this information out there to people. You've got to pass this show around, and you've got to let people know that there is an end game to all of this, and it's not what we think it is. Max Egan did a great broadcast the other day, very, very impressive, and so I'm very honored to have him back. Max, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. Nice to be here again.
Absolutely, absolutely. Before we get into it, where can people tune in to that broadcast that I heard the other day?
It's on my website, thecrowhouse.com. Is a broadcast called Sandy Hook, an American Coup d'Etat. You'll find it on YouTube as well if you just Google that name, or you can just go to the radio archives of The Crow House. You can look at the YouTube version, or you can download the MP3.
Well, here we are, and it is scary, I've got to say. But we've got to put the fear behind us. That's what we talked about in the first hour. We've got to disconnect ourselves from all emotion, and we've got to critically think, because we are about to be checkmated if we don't. So I don't know where you want to begin, Max, but do you want to begin at the beginning of Sandy Hoax? What were some of the things that really stuck out to you about the situation?
Well, the thing about it, I mean, it was all so confusing when you look, you take every, component of it individually. It's all very confusing, and a lot of it, you start thinking these people are actors, and were there any bodies, where are the children? I mean, there's so many questions, Gene Rosen's audition tape, all sorts of things. It's ridiculous the amount of questions that are posed by this case. But stepping back and looking at it from a much more broader perspective, it fits really well on the global stage. And with what they want to do, if they want to take the guns from the American people and they want to lock the system down, they really have to find a way of vilifying those people who are speaking out against the system, i.e. the truth community. Because the YouTube media and the online media, the private media, the media that's coming from the private sector, is now far, far more popular and far more powerful than what the mainstream media is achieving. I mean, there's still certain sections of the mainstream media that people watch and give attention to, but the online private media is a formidable force, and it's really taken over. That, YouTube is where people go for information now. They don't look for the news. If they hear about some event, they search online for it so they can get the real information on it. So it's become a formidable force. So in order to do what they want to do, they need to be able to find a way of vilifying this force. And Sandy Hook does that very, very well. I mean, since the whole event happened, and look, I can't call actors. I can't say they're not actors. I don't know. I wasn't there. There's a lot of it that looks really suspicious, the way Robbie Parker was smiling. Perhaps, who knows? Maybe all these kids were sacrificed a couple of weeks earlier and these people just don't care. They don't feel anything. Who knows? I mean, you could wake up any conspiracy theory you want about it, but ultimately it's irrelevant. What is relevant is how it's being played. And what you're seeing, really, like I said, is a vilification of the truth movement. And you can't prove anything that we think may be going on there. We weren't there. We can't prove it. Not until we get more information. So it's important to see it. So what we've seen is we've seen people like Gene Rosen and even Robbie Parker reporting that they're being harassed by truthers. Robbie Parker saying he had to take down the tribute page for his daughter Emily because of the amount of conspiracy theorists that were posting on there. You've had Gene Rosen come on TV saying how he's getting calls, he's scared to answer his phone, all this sort of stuff. So people are thinking, oh, these poor people who just lost their children, this poor old man who helped the children, who are these crazy people who are harassing them? Oh, they're conspiracy theorists.
Who are these heartless conspiracy theorists?
Exactly. They're conspiracy theorists, and they go searching, and they find sites that tell them that everybody's actors, the whole world's actors, it's all run by one family, and they think, geez, these people are crazy. And not only that, wasn't Adam Lanza, wasn't his mother a prepper? Why was she a prepper? Well, it's because she was a conspiracy theorist. So not only are these conspiracy theorists crazy, and they're ringing up and harassing people, but they're prepared to go out and shoot children. And so these people are the new form of domestic enemy. So that's the way it's been painted. You've really, really got to look at what's going on here. And the people who are calling actors, I mean, who knows? Maybe it was. But the point is, who knows? It's very, very difficult to prove any of this stuff. So you just got to step back and look at it a bit wider, I think, and really look at what's been going on here.
And well, I think it's the same. It's the same concept between were there planes or on 9/11 or was it holograms? You know, it's kind of irrelevant. It's just to create infighting within the truther community, for lack of a better term. And I kind of like the term truther. Before I didn't, but you know, I thought to myself, what's the opposite of a truther? A liar. Okay, label me a truther rather than a liar. But anyway, side point. The point is, I think it has a lot to do with creating that arguing within our own field of thinking, and therefore they can just look at us and say, look, they can't even agree on anything. This guy's saying that everybody's actors. These guys are saying that Sandy Hoax is an actor. There are people out there debunking the Sandy Hoax information vicariously by debunking other people who have said that every single event in history was staged actors. So it's all been played very well.
Hey, it's all infighting, divide and conquer. That's what it's all about. People are wondering about the little details, but they're not looking at the big event. It's like people who look at 9/11 and they say, well, if it wasn't the Arabs, then who was it? Well, that's not even a question. I mean, how do we know who it was? Because we've never had a real investigation. That's the point, you know? So, I mean, you can't say who it was, but I can tell you who it wasn't, because the evidence suggests that the government conspiracy theory is completely wrong. So it must have been something else. So let's have an investigation to find out who it was. That's the point. The point is that it seems to be obviously staged, and the people in government won't let us investigate it, so that implies guilt. And it's the same with all of these things. You know, you can't say were these actors or were they not, but how's it being played? Where's it fit on the global stage? We can see where 9/11 fitted. It created the whole need for this global war on terror, this enlarging of the U.S. empire, which is what it is. You know, or the Crown Corporation Empire, which is what it is. So that's how it's being played. And this next section, I mean, whether the children died or not, I mean, I don't mean it's irrelevant, but it's irrelevant on the global stage. It isn't about whether they died or not. It's about how it's being played. And the way it's being played is to not only take guns, but also to create conflict and to vilify certain sections of the community. You've got all these FEMA camps there. You've got all these hollow points. You've got everything there ready for this to happen. And I think they've made it so obvious because they're pushing. They're like the bully in the schoolyard. And they're taunting people. Even the last drawing of the child, the picture that they gave to Obama, it was an owl. Of course it was an owl. Had to be an owl. Couldn't be a pony. Couldn't be a cat. Couldn't be a fish. Had to be an owl. This is for all the conspiracy theorists. They're baiting you. They're taunting you. They're saying, come along. Come on, call it. Call it. You know, push. Because they're just waiting to push back. And that's what we've got to be careful about. I think we've still got an opportunity to do it peacefully. We've still got an opportunity to take matters in hand and impeach the president, impeach the whole upper house if you have to, you know, the entire executive branch. I mean, if they're going to take the guns away from the American people, I mean, it's not permitted. No one can just write a law on a piece of paper and say we're going to disarm the population. It just doesn't work like that. That's not how America was founded. So I think people have to be careful the way they play this, and they have to be very, very careful calling actors and pointing the finger at people if they don't have rock-solid evidence. Because there's sites that have been set up well in advance of this event to completely undermine the concept that there were actors used. That's what these sites are for. And if I was going to do that, I mean, it makes perfect sense. If the government is going to stage an event like this, whether or not they're going to use actors or not, but if they're going to make it look obvious like this, make it look obvious like it's a conspiracy theory, and they're going to use the event to not only disarm the American people, but to also carry out what is essentially a silent coup d'etat, and remove the people of their weapons and take over the government and immerse it into a corporate system, even more than what it is, then, of course, they're going to set this up well in advance. And that's what all of this disinformation has been put out there for. I completely believe it.
Kind of like Lenin did with the Soviet Union. They basically had almost no army whatsoever during the revolution. But then later on, about five to 10 years down the line, they made a documentary. It was, quote unquote, a documentary about the Russian Revolution, and they had thousands of these extras for it, saying that it was this huge revolution when really it was only a couple hundred people.
Well, let's look at another possibility besides an extinction of people that think like us as they move towards this gun control. They could be provoking a revolution that they make the people believe that they've won and then install one of their own puppets that turns around and turns on everybody. We saw that in the French Revolution. So
and
that's
also
a possibility,
in Africa,
too.
All over the place in Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. I mean, all the world is a stage, brother. You know, it's all anything major that happens is planned to happen that way every single time. You know, like these people know what they're doing. The only wild card for them at the moment is the internet and the alternate media, because they don't know which way we're going to go. And a lot of people get very, very easily ruffled, and a lot of people jump to conclusions in the alternate media. And so it's very, very important for those who have any type of audience to be very responsible in looking at this information and really try to look at the bigger picture and not jump to conclusions. I mean, there's a lot in this that made you want to jump in. I was looking at it. The first time I saw Robbie Parker, I'm going, hang on, that's not right. Why is he laughing like that? Is this guy an actor or what? Is he acting? Did he actually lose kids? I mean, but then you step back and you look at the wider picture after a few days and you go, okay, now how did this video footage of this guy, Gene Rosen, leaning on the car and rehearsing his lines and saying wait in the middle of it and blah, blah. I mean, how did that even get on the internet? What's that all about? Why is it there? And I'm thinking this has all been put there to stir up people. And then you have dates being changed on these sites on Twitter and stuff that are set up to, they're saying, oh, this is a tribute site for the kids that was set up in the 10th of November. And you find, hang on, they've been changing timestamps on Twitter. Why would they do this?
A Facebook page that appears and then disappears again.
Exactly. Why? Yeah. These are all setups. It's all been set up to taunt people. There are people that have set this whole controversy in place. Whether the kids died or whether they didn't, it's how it's being played. And they've set this whole controversy in place to bait the truth movement, to get the response that they've got now, where they've got people who just helped out these poor dead children coming on TV saying that they're being harassed by conspiracy theorists. You know, so, and then you look at the connections. I mean, that's the important part as well. You know, the fact that Adam Lanza's mother was a prepper. Why was she a prepper? Because she was expecting some calamity, because she was a conspiracy theorist. These conspiracy theorists, they're stocking up on guns, they're educating their children that there's this global conspiracy, that the kids are cracking, buying guns and going out and shooting children. We've got to put a stop to this. We need Homeland Security to take all the guns. We need these guys to protect us, because all these people that are speaking out against the government, they're all crazy, and not only that, but they're prepared to go and kill children. You know, that's how it's been painted, you know.
Sheree, did you want to step in?
Well, there was also a rumor going around that there was a connection between the shooter's father and the LIBOR scandal as well. And then I just looked it up, and according to OccupyCorporatism.com, there was no viable connection whatsoever. Well, but I have no idea.
Well, the whole LIBOR legal thing, that actually came from a source known as Saoirse Fale.
And, did it?
That's a well-known disinformation source.
Saoirse Fale.
Yeah, someone actually gave me that link. They told me that. They said that. They typed it to me in Skype while I was on air with someone. And I looked at it while I was being interviewed by someone. I said, and apparently there's a link with LIBOR. I mean, what's the chances of that, you know? But I found out after the show that it was disinformation. I hate it when people send me links when I'm on air. But, you get that.
You get bombarded.
Well, that's where that information apparently came from. So there's a lot of stuff that's been put out there to muddy the waters. But it's how it's being played, you know. That's the important part in this. And that's why people, alternate researchers and so-called conspiracy theorists, I mean, what's the point of ringing up Gene Rosen and harassing him? What's the point of sending hate mail to these people? You don't know what's going on. And even if you suspect that these people are actors, well, you should go out and do investigations. Do your own investigation. Don't just look at what's been posted there online to whip you up into hate towards these people. Go and do your own investigation and track them. Track it down, find out what they do, follow the money, find out who they actually are, where they were. Find out a little bit of information about them before you go and attack people online, because by doing this, you're just playing into the hands of the controllers. Right. That's exactly what they want. They want this conflict, you know.
Well, of course they do. And Max, from an American to an Australian, I am so sorry for the people of my country when it comes to problem solving, because we tend to grasp at the easiest answer and the easiest route to get out of a situation. And I'm sorry, but there's a lot of people in this country that the first thing they think of whenever they think of things like this is, you know what, I'm going to get that bastard on the line. I'm going to, you know, ask him about this and ask him what his involvement is in all of this. And I'm going to take care of this, damn it. And
well, that's, I mean, I have to admit that that's my first instinct as well.
Exactly.
However, I've, in my journey, I've come to realize exactly what Max said, that there's still a lot more work before you can respond from emotion. But I think it's just natural for anybody who's outraged at an event like this. I mean, think about it. If people really believed, and I'm sure they do, I really believe that they used actors, I would be very outraged at these actors. How dare you perpetrate this hoax on people? But we have to use our discernment first. And
right, because that's what they want. They want us to call him up and chew him out and have him go off to CNN and say, they're being mean to me.
Exactly. And my first instinct is, you know what? I'm going to grab my guns if I see UN troops on my soil, and I'm going to fight, and I'm going to die proudly. That's my first instinct. It's natural for us in the Patriot community to think that way. But we have to go past that, because we have to think like chess players.
Well, you do, you know, like, even if you suspect these people are actors, innocent until proven guilty, the same as you would expect for yourself. Doesn't matter what the circumstantial evidence is. You know, if someone's told you something online, well, look into it for yourself and then make a judgment. Don't just believe what you're told. You know, you've got to use discernment. And then if you find out that you are correct, well, there's a better way to go about it than ringing up and threatening these people. Provide a good, report on the topic and publish it. Put it online. Let people know what's going on. You know, take action through your community. You don't have to ring up and harass people because it just paints you as crazy. And a lot of people do that. They do it. They get half cocked and they go off and they just harass people because they're told that something is a certain way and they don't really do the investigation for themselves.
Well, that's why I have primarily throughout the last month stayed out of the conversation when it came to Sandy Hook, just in general, because I don't want to be one of those people that falls for the disinformation or refeeds that to people when it's not true. I don't want people to believe something that's not true on account of me. And so I focus more on the effect, what has happened because of this, whether it's a hoax or not a hoax.
Exactly.
And what I see the most is demonization of conspiracy theorists and truthers and preppers and gun bans.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. And unfortunately, a lot of people, I mean, it's the American culture, you know, people are sort of trained to think this way and they always look for the tabloid response, you know, something like a National Enquirer sort of a feel to it, you know what I mean? They like to hear that it was Jesus and he had an alien baby while he was doing it, you know, so you've got to really see the way people have been trained to think and trained to react to these sorts of ideas.
And me and Chris were discussing this before we brought you on. But the fact that about a third of us, 1 in 3 to 1 in 5, they said, are on some sort of psychotropic medication. And so when you enter into a social arena involving dead kids and conspiracy theories and on a head full of antidepressants, you're bound to start thinking some really crazy stuff. And what we're concerned with is those people and how they're going to react to all this information. We're going to cover that when we get right back. Truth Frequency Radio with Max Egan on the other side.
Check out the Crow House during the break too. TheCrowHouse.com, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. A little bit of misfiring going on there with the automation, but it's okay because we're going to get back on topic here. Cherie, what were you saying before the break?
Well, I was just, we were talking about gun control and, actually, during the break, I brought up a good point to Chris, and it's about coercion versus force. And that's really the only way that a government can disarm the people, either coercion or force. And there's been a good amount of coercion going on the past 5 to 10 years. It's focused on giving people in densely urban areas free gift cards to Best Buy or something of that nature in return for turning your guns in. And on some level, there is some level where I can see that that might be a good thing. I mean, just in places like downtown Chicago or the bad side of Chicago or the bad side of a really big city. I can understand if I was like a sheriff in those places, why I would encourage them to turn their guns in. I mean, would you rather the crackhead have an iPod or a Glock? You know, but I think that they're realizing that coercion's not going to work, especially on a national level. And so they're going to do it by force. I really believe that they will if they have to. And it would just be par for the course because every other government in the world, except for Sweden, has done the same thing. So why wouldn't it happen to us?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they would, of course, they're going to. I don't think it's really a matter of turning the guns in at all. I think it's a matter of education. I think all these crimes come from miseducation. I think we live in societies that are designed to create this situation. You know, you create the chaos so you can bring about the control. You know, order out of chaos. That's what they always do. And it was great that you mentioned, what was it, Switzerland, because...
Oh, Switzerland, yes.
In Switzerland, every person is obligated to own a gun and to be trained to use it. And Switzerland has the lowest crime rate in the world. So it's a matter of education. You know, I don't think that the crackhead should be disarmed. I think the crackhead should be rehabilitated because he's suffering an illness. It's not a crime. Being addicted to drugs isn't a crime. It's a medical problem. It's not a political or a criminal problem. It's a medical problem. And it's a result of the society we live in. And all the biggest drug runners in our society are the government. So who's really responsible for this? They create the problems and they say, oh, look, the crackhead's got a gun. We've got to take all your guns. But they created the crackhead. They brought the crack in for a start. So,
right.
You know, it's a criminal empire and people need to wake up to it. And I think because people are waking up to it so much, the alternate research movement on the internet is having such an impact on society that the people are running scared. The government's running scared. They're very, very scared of the people. Otherwise, they wouldn't be going to the extreme lengths they're going to bring all this about and to disarm the people.
Well, it just shows how desperate they are because coming full circle to what we were talking about before the break, the people on the psychopharmaceuticals, these executive orders that Obama put in last week, one of them specifically mentions psychiatrists, having full access to the system that they put you in to not be able to have a gun. And they're gonna basically merge everything together, with Obamacare and gun control and weave it into it. And so these psychiatrists are gonna have these people coming in and they're going to deem them unworthy of having a firearm. They'll send that information over to the DHS or whoever's going to take your guns away. They'll come to your house, they'll take your guns away, and that'll be the end of it. It's not even going to be like this armed revolt that we're going to pull off in this, you know, distant future. There's not going to be an armed revolt because it's going to happen on an individual level, is what I think.
Oh, yeah, they'll do a lot of that, of course. I mean, because you are now classed as unstable because we diagnosed one of your emotional problems as an illness and gave you a psychotropic drug that was going to send you crazy, we're now going to come and take your gun, you know.
Well, and the justification for that is going to be all these people that are taking these prescription drugs going nuts on and shooting people.
Well, I mean, that's why they gave them all the drugs. I mean, if they're saying that the problem is that there were 80,000 people died from gunshot wounds in 1 year in the United States, well, in that same year, there were 260,000 people died from FDA-approved drugs. So why aren't they banning the FDA? It's obviously much, much worse killer than guns are. And guns don't kill people anyway. It's usually people who kill people using guns, and they usually do so because they're on an FDA-approved drug. So that might say something, you know. But, of course, I mean, they've diagnosed everybody. If you've got an emotional problem or you've got anything going on in your life and you're not a complete drone living in absolute acceptance of this crazy world, then you've got a psychological problem. We'll put you on a drug so now we can put you on this catalog and so now you can be classed as this type of person and we can take your weapons away from you. And they do this to virtually everybody, you know. Like, to put everybody on medication. Any complaint at all, yep, we'll put you on medication. You know?
You walk into a doctor's office nowadays and you tell them, you know, my mother just died. They want to immediately put you on antidepressants. It's not even have you been feeling poorly? You know, tell me about it. It's, oh, well, your mother died, so automatically you should be taking Prozac.
And exactly.
That is how bad it is nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. It's mass drugging of the population. So they can, I did a show in the middle of last year called Total Criminalization. This is what they want to do. They want to make sure that everybody is criminal. Everybody is at least on record in the justice system. That total criminalization, that way they know where everybody is and what everybody's doing. They've got a file on everybody. That's what they want. And that's what they're heading for. And they do this very, very well through the medical industry. So now they've got everybody on medication. Now you've got these staged events where you've got people who are supposedly on these medications. You're going out killing people. Of course, we need to add these databases together.
Pot smoker who's been using medical marijuana and has a legitimate medical marijuana card for his state is automatically unable to have a firearm.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's probably because the pot smoker can think outside of the box, you know.
Uh-huh.
But most pot smokers probably wouldn't want a firearm anyway, you know.
Right, but still, it's just the dichotomy there that it's okay to take a bunch of pills every day and drive and own a firearm and do whatever you want. But if you smoke medical marijuana, oh, not allowed to have a gun. If you're driving under the influence, we're going to charge you with blah, blah, blah. And even if it's in your system, we're going to consider that driving under the influence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, well, that's just one aspect of it, yeah. But, you know, the way they've done it, the way they've set everybody up already through this mass medicating of the population, they've already got this system in place, and now they can merge it. And now they've got this whole cross-section database. I know what drugs people are on everywhere. And this gives an opportunity for the Department of Homeland Security to get tabs on all these people that have had this medication that they wouldn't normally have tabs on. They wouldn't normally be classed as criminals or a danger to society. But now that we've got people on this medication going out and supposedly committing all these crimes, well, of course, we need to merge these systems. So all of this has been a step-by-step process. They've known exactly what they're doing right from the very beginning. And this is all part of the process. And that's what I think is important about Sandy Hook, is to see how the whole thing's being played. It's a real consolidation. Like I said on that last show, they've put the human race in check. And if we don't come up with a good move, and this move has to be spiritual empowerment. It has to be us moving into our hearts and starting to hold these people accountable for their actions. Now, yesterday I did a show where I explained how the whole corporate system in Australia works, just to try to help people understand that it is a corporate system and get them to maybe look into how it works in their own countries. Because you're going to find that you're all subject to corporate systems that you have no contract with, and governments are not doing what we employ them to do. They're all in breach of trust, and the human race really has to stand up and do something about it. And I think the internet and all of these things that they're doing that are right in your face now, I think it's providing us with the best opportunity we've ever had to be able to do this, because this is the first time that it's all been laid so bare for everybody. That's why they're vilifying the truth movement. That's why they're trying to take the guns. They know the danger that they're in, because the world is waking up. And there is a real battle for supremacy going on at the moment. And I think consciousness is going to win. I really do. If we stay staunch and we stay calm and we stay in our hearts and we speak our truth from our hearts as natural men and women of this planet, peaceful inhabitants of our own countries, then we have a real opportunity here, and we will get through this. But if we fall into their corporate system, fall into their legal system, fall down their trap of creating conflict, which is, I believe, what they want, I think this attack on the Second Amendment and making Sandy Hook so blatantly look like a conspiracy, even if it wasn't, I mean, that's all way down. It's irrelevant now when I look at it. It's not even relevant whether it was a conspiracy or not. It's how much it was made to look like one and how it's being played. If we don't really come into some sort of spiritual power and stand in who we are, then, we're going to get in trouble. And I think it's an opportunity for us to do it, and I think we will. Because the more they lock people down, the more people wake up to what's going on.
I think you're right. It's just sad to me to know that we actually have to ask ourselves if there really are dead children involved in this whole situation. That's sad that we have to think like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the type of world we live in. That's the type of media we've got. You can't believe anything you see from the media. You can't believe anything you read in the history books. I mean, it's all written by the winners. It's all written by the controllers. It's all theater. And everything major happens for a reason. And it's how we play it. It's how we respond to it. That's the important part. And it's how it's being played. And there is a real battle for supremacy going on here at the moment. And we could allow ourselves to be really locked down, move totally into fear, move totally into conflict, and allow this police state to be locked down. Or we could simply come into our hearts and start respecting each other and stand up and say, hey, enough is enough. We're not gonna do this anymore. We've realized that this whole system you've created only exists on paper. You know, the world's just being trashed around us because we're not paying attention. And we're starting to do this now. We're paying attention now. And I don't, like I've often said, I don't wish any harm against these people. If it comes to it, I will defend myself. But I don't wish any harm upon them. I don't want to attack them. I don't want to kill them. I just don't want them to run the world into the ground the way they're doing. I don't want them to lock the human race down into a cage the way they're doing. I don't want them to allow that type of future to be created for my son. I don't think the human race deserves to go down that path for all the bad things that the human race has done, for all the conflict and all the division and all the hate that we've shown towards each other and all our lack of compassion for each other that we've shown. I still don't think we deserve to go down that path. I think we are capable of incredibly fantastic things if given the opportunity to do so. And I think that's what we're being provided with here. But we have to step back and see what's going on. We really have to seize the opportunity with both hands. And those people out there who are awake really do need to speak out about what's going on, but do it from their heart. You know, show this compassion. Lead by example in all that they do. That's how we change things. And if we don't do it, then they will lock the place down. You know, so we have to start respecting each other. That's really what it's all about. All this division, all the stuff that's happening now, the attacks that I'm getting from people like Wellaware One and Goldbug with all this disinformation, all of this stuff that happens, it happens all at the right time to try to lock you down into a lower frequency. So you don't respond to it that way. Just question it in the right way, deal with it in the right way, and realize this is the way it's being played. And it's up to what's important is you. What's important is in your heart. What's important is how you react to the situation, how you react to reality. Even with the corporate system that we're facing, I don't wish any harm on anyone. I don't wish any harm or any confrontation with any police officers. But I can't allow the planet that I live on to be raped any longer because of this paper-based, economically-based reality. That's all fiction. We made it all up. You know, and to me, I look at it, I've often said, God created man and gave man dominion over the earth. God created man, and everything below man is fiction. Everything below that is fiction that we all created. This whole social setup, this whole legal setup, it's all fiction. We made the whole thing up. And when it gets to a point where this system doesn't benefit humankind or benefit human consciousness anymore, then it's up to us to take responsibility for that and to change the direction it's going in. Now, because we're all the custodians of this planet, every single one of us are custodians of this planet. And that's the way we need to look at it, because that's the only way we're going to fix it. We can't allow this corporate system to fix it or expect it to. You know, the problem will never be fixed from the same level of consciousness that created the problem. Somebody said that or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. But, you won't fix it from there because that's who created it. And not only that, they created a system to ensure that you could never fix it using that system. So we have to step above it and realize that everything below man is fiction. We are all divine consciousness, and we have the ability to take the world in any direction we choose to do so, and all we have to do it is to respect each other, and we're not going to do that until we respect ourselves. So it has to come from within. You know, you change your heart space and apply it to the world around you, and the world changes. It's ridiculously simple to fix all of this, you know, but it requires the individual waking up to themselves, and I guess that's the hard part. But, you know, waking up to themselves, all I'm really asking them to do is to see their own perfection. That's really all they have to do. Forget about all the yardsticks and fictional goals that have been set up for you by society. They're all fiction. They're all designed to lead you away from yourself. All you have to do is look within, and there's the answer to all the problems. That's what I've been trying to do with the crowhouse.com for so long. And that's been the message ever since I started. And that's the message that I get from this whole Sandy Hook event. It's an opportunity to do this. And if we don't do it, we're going to go down a bad path. So we've got to start respecting each other and respecting ourselves.
Amen, brother. I completely agree with you 100% on that. Let me ask you this. This is a very difficult question. And, of course, this is just in theory. But we are going to face a situation sooner or later. We have UN troops on our soil going around taking away people's guns. Where is the edge of the coin? Because heads we stand up and we die proudly. Tails, we turn in our guns and we effectively give up our freedoms. But there's got to be that edge of the coin. And even though the possibility may be minute that it will land on its edge, the edge has to exist. What is the edge of the coin?
Well, I guess the edge of the coin is when your country gets invaded by a foreign force, you know?
Well, what do we do in that situation?
Well, I'd call home the military. In that sort of a situation, I mean, if the president doesn't react to something like that, or if the president was the one who instigated something like that, then that's obviously sedition and treason. And whoever's in control of the military, I would suggest a military coup could even happen in such a situation, where one of the head generals of the military would take over the role and call the forces home to deal with the invasion that's happening on American soil. I mean, the UN has no place in the United States. The UN has no place in any country where there isn't a conflict, where there aren't terrorists. I mean, most of the countries it's in, it has no place in any of these countries anyway. But it certainly has no place on the streets of the United States disarming the population. That's an invasion. That's an invasion by a foreign force, namely the United Nations. And so this would be a very delicate situation. I'd say that any American patriots or any American people would be defending themselves against an obvious invasion of that type, and I hope it doesn't come to that.
I'm right there with you, brother. I really hope it doesn't come down to it, but I don't see anything else happening. We have too many oath keepers here. We have too many local police that have stated that they'll put federal agents in jail if they try to violate the Second Amendment. Others have nullified the all the totalitarian gun ban legislation. I mean, you can even see it in the medicinal marijuana states, the conflict between the federal government and the states. We have a lot of states that are willing to stand up. So I do foresee that conflict within our country, which prompts UN, quote-unquote, peacekeeping troops to intervene. And
well, you know, like,
it's going to be disastrous.
Well, hopefully it won't get that far, because hopefully as soon as the president seeks to write a document essentially nullifying the Second Amendment, hopefully he'll be arrested. Hopefully there are patriots still within government. There are still people who respect the Constitution. Hopefully there are articles of impeachment being drawn up as we speak in preparation for the event, so that as soon as he signs the paper, he is handed articles of impeachment and arrested. I mean, that's what should happen. If that happens, I mean, if he does sign a document to essentially nullify the Second Amendment, well, then the Second Amendment will have to be used, unfortunately. That's what it's for. I think someone said that you'll never have to use it until they go to take it away from you. And, hopefully that's what's happening now. Hopefully there are forces, maybe Kaepernick, maybe someone in there, some political figure who knows how to draft the right papers is hopefully drafting papers of impeachment right now, in preparation should such a signing occur, because it will be treason and, you know, action will have to be taken. I mean, before it comes to civil war, hopefully that's the way it will be dealt with.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Australian situation and when all of this happened in Australia? What was it like before? What was it like afterwards? And what's it like now? And where do you see Australia moving to as well?
Look, I never had a gun, so I didn't really notice the whole gun confiscation. It was a confiscation of automatic weapons. You still can't get rifles, you still can't get handguns, but you've got to belong to a club, you've got to have a reason for having it. You can't get, you can only get limited magazine capacities, and you can't get any semi-automatics, I don't think.
So basically, you're like us 5 years from now.
Well, yeah, you've got to really jump through hoops to get a gun license. You really do, you know. You've got to, or else join a pistol club or something like that. Then you can't keep the ammo anywhere near the gun. You got to keep the ammo in a safe and the gun in a different place. And you know, so it's pretty ridiculous. But, I didn't really notice it personally because I've never been a gun person. But the year that they confiscated the guns, the crime rate went right up. It absolutely went up a lot. But I don't know how it's been since then. I haven't really kept up on the statistics as to where we've got more gun crime now or not. But, I mean, I think the actual amount of gun crime and the actual amount of shooting, I think it's about the same because, of course, the criminals didn't have their guns registered, so they didn't give them up anyway.
Right, exactly.
Which is probably why gun crime went up in the first year. So, I mean, personally, I haven't noticed much difference. And the Australian people are pretty apathetic, and we don't have like police. I mean, they carry guns now, but they don't. There's not very many shootings by police and all that sort of stuff in Australia. You know, they can be quite brutish and quite thuggish, but sometimes they can be okay. So it's kind of a different laid back sort of a culture here, you know. There's not really, it's not easy to compare with America at all, which is a gun culture. But people right. are now seeing that it's starting to come down to the wire now with all the mining that they're doing in the country, because that's the big thing here. I mean, Australia is basically a mine. That's what it is. They're going to turn it into the world's resource mine and the world's nuclear waste dump. That's basically what they want this country for. So
I've got to just jump in for just a second and just say how much I love the audience. I've received multiple messages asking the exact same question. Ask Max what happened in Australia. I just got a chance to read those messages, so I'm glad we're all tuned into the Truth Frequency this evening, ladies and gentlemen. One thing that I do want to point out, Max, is one of the listeners in his comments said that there were raids in 1996, and he says, as I recall, raids after the buybacks and voluntary surrender. So they did go aggressive once they disarmed voluntarily the majority of the population. Do you recall that?
Oh yeah, they still do occasionally, but it's usually these people are painted as bike gangs or whatever, or you know, packs of hoodlums living in the woods or whatever. You know, they're probably just preppers and stuff like that. You know, but there are people that have got some reasonable caches of weapons buried around the place. I mean, a lot of people didn't give up their guns. So there are still a lot of guns around if it comes down to the wire. But, yeah, they do. I mean, if you're a bike gang and they think you've got weapons, and they stage a few gang wars here and there as well, so they can get on raid places, you know, stage a few riots. We've had a few riots in Sydney that I'm convinced have been staged. So they do this as well. It gives them an excuse to go on raid places and look for weapons and just see what people are up to.
I can only imagine what we're up against. And like I've said before, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to predict the future, you have to study the past, not only our own past and not the past that they've given you in the schools, but you need to study the past in other countries like Max Egan is describing. Tony Kudos was describing the gun grab in the UK as well. I just want to state for the records, I don't like guns. I'd rather not have them around me. I understand they're a necessary evil. No pun intended there, no, you know, for lack of a better term, but they are a necessary thing that we have to have in order to maintain our freedom. But I would love to see a world without guns. I'd love to see a world without weapons, and I'd love to see a world that's completely peaceful. But like I said in the first hour of the show, until we remove the mentality that the power structure has, the control mentality, I don't think we can ever achieve that. And unfortunately, in this state of duality, in this world of duality, black and white, up and down, left and right, night and day, man and woman, positive, negative, we'll always have that mentality here, so we have to hang on to the freedoms that we have. We're about to go to break, Max, but anything you want to touch upon on that?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, we, like I said, we never really had a gun culture here, and I think in a proper world we wouldn't need them. But the problem isn't that America's got guns. The problem is that the government wants to take the guns away. They want to keep their guns. And there's a problem with that. You know, if I've got a weapon that I never use and you've got one that you never use, but you want to take mine away and keep yours, well, I have a problem with that. I think you might be up to something that may not have my best interest at heart.
Exactly. Don't go anywhere, ladies and gentlemen. Another jam-packed hour. We're also going to bring on Zen Shaman from the chat room. He wanted to speak with Max. Dear friend of ours, so we'll see what's on his mind right on the other side. Right, guys, we are in the final hour of Truth Frequency, and stick around after the show. Forbidden America is debuting right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network with Steve McManus. Very, very good show. Very well-researched gentleman. He was on Hangar 18 with us last week. I believe it was.
Yeah, it was.
And he is a fascinating, fascinating gentleman with a lot of insight into the Illuminati, into the conspiracy realm, into secret societies, and he has a lot of firsthand experience as well. So stick around for that. Now, we do have Zen Shaman on the line with us, a longtime listener, dear friend of ours, and I think he had a couple of questions for Max. So, Zen Shaman, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, good evening, Chris and Sheree. Thank you. Hi, Max. I've been following you for years, and it's a real honor to talk to you.
Oh, lovely to connect with you, brother.
Listen, I I was hoping you could expand on your 10 days in Gaza that you did with Ken O'Keefe. I followed that, and that's something that I'd like to talk about.
Okay, well, I did that when I was in England. We just kind of found an opening that we might be able to get in there, so we went over there and we tried, and we lucked out and got in there. And while we were in there, what we basically did was contact a family called the Samuni family, who'd been subject to some absolutely terrible atrocities in Operation Cast Lead. And we got together to fit out a schoolroom for them. There was a room that had been built through proceeds from the Samuni family project that Ken O'Keefe had been doing anyway. So they sort of created this space for this school area, but they'd never really got it fitted out for the kids to use because all of the problems that Ken had getting in and out of Gaza and blah, 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 I don't really know. I mean, I think there was a lot of problems with infiltrators into it. And it's like this whenever you try to work with anything to do with Palestine, people get in the way and make sure it doesn't happen. So we went over there and we made it happen. And it was absolutely fascinating. And while we were there, we sort of caught the attention of a couple of other people, like from Press TV. So we did an interview on Press TV while we were there. And our translator happened to be a university student at Gaza University. He was the person who sort of basically volunteered to be responsible for us while we were in there and acted as translator for us. And he actually got in a fair bit of trouble from his university for taking so many days off in a row. But he explained that he was with these two foreigners. And so the university asked us to come into the university, and we went and spoke there to the people there. I interviewed some of the university students to ask them why they were really even going to university in Gaza, because they're kind of trapped in there. What is it, you know? Why are you doing this? And they all gave me the same reasons you would hear from any person in any university. They want to make a difference. They want to change the world. They want to be free. They want the world to know that they're not terrorists. They're just people, you know. And what I tried to do with the 10 Days in Gaza film was to just present a view of Palestine and Gaza that was just an everyday view. Not to go and show some bombed out family and tell you their story of how terrible it is and put a dark slant on it, but just to show you real people in a real situation, and that's why I presented it in that way.
Excellent. What was it like going through the different checkpoints through there?
Well, in Gaza, there's actually no checkpoints in Gaza. There's only checkpoints in the West Bank. Are we still on air?
Yeah, we are.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, well, there's no checkpoints in Gaza. There was checkpoints going right across the Sinai, but they're in Egypt. And going across towards Rafah, we only went through about two or maybe three checkpoints going across that way. The checkpoints are, I mean, they're decent checkpoints, I tell you. I mean, you go through there, there's a group of soldiers. There's usually a tank parked on one side of the road and an RV on the other side of the road. The tank's got a turret and a 50 cal, and the RV's got a 50 cal. And there's soldiers there with, you know, beach umbrellas over them, kind of just sitting there, you know. So it's a very imposing checkpoint. It's not just, you know, a little stop here at the roadside stall sort of a thing. They're pretty major checkpoints. But when we got to Rafah, we kind of went in through a back door, really. We got smuggled in by some rebels. We kind of lucked out and just sort of searched around till we found the right people, and in we went. Not something I'd recommend people do. I mean, we were underground for over an hour, and through this little tunnel, it was over a kilometre long. We were crawling for a good deal of the way, about 50 metres underground, and it was quite intense. But coming back from the Gaza Strip into Egypt, there were major checkpoints all the way back. We went through about six checkpoints on the way back. And some of them were very, very intense checkpoints. The one where you cross the Suez Canal is a very, very touchy checkpoint. And they sort of scrutinized us a bit, you know, because they're looking for evidence that you've been into Gaza or something like that, you know. It was interesting because we actually lost our luggage on the way out. We got detained on the border and our luggage ended up going missing, and we got it back later. But when we were traveling across the Sinai, we didn't have our luggage with us, which sort of proved kind of beneficial in many ways, because it kind of looked like we'd just been out there on a day trip when we were going back through the checkpoints. we got some phone calls from the driver of our luggage who brought our luggage through, who was actually a little bit apprehensive about bringing luggage across the Sinai. He needed our assurance that there was nothing in there that would indicate that we'd been in Palestine. So it was all pretty touch and go.
Max, let me ask you this. What if they had determined that you had been in Palestine? What would the repercussions be, or what would their actions be?
Well, I don't know. I can only speculate on that. I had stuff with me that clearly, I mean, it was clearly Palestinian.
Yeah, but the IDF are like masters of overreaction.
Well, I wasn't in Israel, though. I was in Egypt.
Okay, so going into Egypt.
We're going across the Sinai. We're going from Rafah to Cairo across the Sinai. These are Egyptian guys. They're not Israelis. I mean, every time we went at a checkpoint, they look in the window and they go, Palestini. First thing they said, Palestini. And see if there's any Palestinians in the car. They look at our passports. Sometimes they detain us for a couple of minutes, and sometimes they wouldn't, you know. And it was all, you know, but they looked and they were sort of scrutinizing. And when we left Egypt, or when we left Rafah, we got told by the person who left. He said, "Look, you should take our driver. We know you've got a driver here waiting for you, but you should take our driver because he will get you through the checkpoints." And so we went, okay, we'll take your driver. I said, no worries, that'll be $100. Yeah. So, but, it's all good. We got back to Cairo. Okay. But it was a tense sort of an exit, but the trip inside there, the time inside Gaza was life changing. It really was. It gave you a real impression of what these people really are, you know, and what they're actually going through inside there. And building the schoolroom for these children, because they want to go to school, but they can't afford to go to a normal school. See, a lot of these people, these children are orphans. They don't have any parents. They might have a mother, but the mother can't work because she's looking after the children. And they're fortunate that they own the land that they're on, but their husband's gone. She can't afford to send the children to school. The children want to go to school, but they can't afford to go there. And if they go to school, they've got to go to either a Fatah school or a Hamas school. They just want to go to school, you know. I mean, there's universities. There's one university that's Fatah. There's one that's Hamas, and then there's Gaza University, which is just for people who just want to learn. But there's no schools like that. It's either Fatah or Hamas. It's either one way or the other. And
what I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, these kids just want to learn. They don't want any doctrine. They just want to learn. They want to learn how to read. They want to learn how to communicate with each other. They just want to go to school the way kids do, you know. So we created this whole area where the Samouni family can basically be homeschooled in this schoolroom. And maybe it can be expanded for other kids. And, you know, so that's what it was all about, you know. Because these children as well, the Samouni family children have been so traumatized that you can't expect them to just go back to a normal school. I mean, what these kids have been through is absolutely horrific, what they went through in Cast Lead. It is absolutely horrific. So you can't expect these kids to just go back to a normal school and be taught by normal methods, you know.
What about the Palestinian Authority? What's their role in all of this? Are they just basically the bookkeepers and they don't really intervene in situations that such as you mentioned with a bunch of kids with dead parents?
Well,
how do they step in and help?
Well, the Palestinian Authority controls the West Bank. They are the government of the West Bank. They're not they don't really control what goes on in Gaza. Gaza's run by Hamas.
Okay.
You know, Palestinian Authority is basically Fatah. That's President Abbas, and I don't particularly agree with Abbas. I don't like what he's doing. Hey, I'm not a Palestinian. Who am I to say? You know, but I don't like the way it's being played at the moment since the UN announcement recognizing it as a state. I don't like the way it's being played. I think Abbas gets far too many handouts from other countries to want to rock the boat. But I think that there's a real opportunity here. If Palestine now has this statehood status, it mounts legal challenges, then it could go a long way to achieving a lot. But I don't particularly like the direction the Palestinian Authority is going. And the Palestinian Authority doesn't do anything about what's going on in the West Bank. They don't do anything about appealing to other Arab nations to help the people in Gaza to lift these sanctions, to get this, you know, to put pressure on Israel to get the borders opened. You know, and Hamas is a legitimately elected government. And the interesting thing about it, I mean, really, Fatah was formed by Yasser Arafat. Hamas was formed by Israel to stand in opposition to Fatah, formed by Yasser Arafat. And then when Hamas is voted to power, Israel declares Gaza, you know, a terrorist state held by a terrorist government, and it's now dealing with Fatah, who it created Hamas to depose. What's going on here? Can anyone see the double play that's going on here?
It's a love triangle, a political love triangle.
Oh, it's unbelievable, you know. So what about the people? What about the people of Gaza? Why can't these people just be recognized as normal people? Why can't the borders be open? Why can't they have parts to fix the sewage treatment plants? Why can't they have parts to fix the electricity plant? Why can't they have concrete to build their buildings again? Oh, no, they might be building rocket launch pads, you know.
Oh, well, Max, they're going, you know what they're going through right now? They're dropping like flies from the same thing that me and Chris had when we were on our honeymoon, the swine flu. They're dropping like flies over there because they don't have those sewage systems and water treatment plant systems in place anymore.
Yeah, I know. It's a very, very unhealthy environment because the sewage plant's overflowing into the ocean and you can't have, you know, the power on all the time, you know, so. You know, power's off for 8 to 16 hours a day, you're having salt water showers, all this sort of stuff that they're dealing with. So there's a lot to deal with for these people. And, you know, but the Palestinian Authority isn't doing anything about this. So.
And the problem is right now that Israel is withholding the tax dollars that are taxed directly upon the Palestinian people. They're not giving it back.
Right.
So there's a lot of dynamics going on here. Not only are they not allowing humanitarian aid in, but they're taxing the people and then holding on to the taxes.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. And they're taxing another country. I mean, they're taxing Palestine, which is unforgivable anyway. And then they're saying, well, because you got recognized by the UN, or actually because you even asked for recognition, we're withholding your allowance, basically.
Oh, not only that, but we're going to start giving more of your land away. And to prove it, here's, what, 125 more settlements in East Jerusalem?
Yep.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is a war crime. It's ethnic cleansing. This is what it's always been about. A lot of people are here talking about it. They say, you know, the Islam and the Judaic, they need to learn how to get on with each other. Well, it's not about that. It's not about the Muslims and the Jews. It's about land theft, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid. That's what it's about. It's what it's always been about. And religion's just the smokescreen that they're using for it. But, you know, it's a whole Zionist agenda. I mean, that's what Zionism is. It's to replace Palestine with Israel. You know, make the whole place Israel. That's what it's all about. And then Palestinian people can just go away. You're an Arab. Go somewhere else. Go to Egypt. Go to Yemen. Go somewhere. Just not here. You know? That's what they want.
Well, I mean, they don't even let them go anywhere else, though. That's the thing. Whenever they try to go to another country, that other country won't take them. And they get turned around and sent back to their own filth. So basically what they're doing is they're blocking off an entire race of people in and trapping them in their own filth and waiting for them to die.
Yeah, basically it's a slow kill. See, now that they've got recognition, maybe they can now get a passport. Maybe they can go somewhere if a country will accept them. But unfortunately, most of our countries are run by people who support the Zionist agenda and they don't care about the Palestinians. They just don't want to do anything that may seem as, to upset Israel. So, yeah, it's all about appeasing Israel because they're the eternal victim because they made the story up that said it was that way, you know?
What's stopping Russia or Iran or somebody not involved in the Zionist movement to step in and give these people passports and give these people asylum?
Well, they've got to have a country to do that. According to the global political system and the whole corporate system, we all need passports to travel. You've got to give them nationality. They don't have a nationality.
Yeah, that's the difficulty. They can't get a passport. And if they do manage to get a passport, how are they going to get a visa? Nobody will give them a visa.
Right.
Yeah, because they're a terrorist. They're a Palestinian, so they're automatically a terrorist. And if you're a Palestinian, this is what happened to our translator. He was living in Dubai. Okay? His mother and father were Palestinian, or his father, one of his family was Palestinian. They moved to Dubai when he was a very, very small child, but he was born in Palestine. But they moved to Dubai. And when he turned 21, he was just a baby when he moved there. He lived there. He was working for IBM or some computer company. You know, he was there. He was driving around. He was making $3,000 or $4,000 a month, you know, driving a nice car, living in Dubai, you know, just a nice cruisy Arab nation. And he turned 21 and he was up to that time, he'd been living on a permanent residence visa. But as soon as he turned 21, they said, nope, you're Palestinian. We won't renew your visa. You'll have to go home to Palestine. And they moved him to Gaza. from Dubai. He was 21 years old. He'd spent 20 years in Dubai, and suddenly he found himself in Gaza. He's been there now for 2 years. And he says, Max, I'm going crazy. Yeah, I mean, you can't even work here. I mean, you can work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and you might get, do that for a month, and you might get $400, you know. And what's the point? What's the point of working for anything? Where can I go? What can I do with anything that I do here? What do I do? What life have I got here? I live in an area that's 5 miles wide, 25 miles long, and I've got to work for everything that I do, and what can I do with any of it? I can't do anything because I'm not recognized as a person, and if I try to go to another country, well, they won't accept me because I'm a Palestinian, but I can't anyway because I don't have a nationality. They can't accept me in Dubai because I can't, now that I'm 21, I can't apply for residency because I don't have a nationality. Who am I applying? Where do I come from? I don't come from anywhere. Palestine? Where's that? You mean Pakistan? You know? That's what people say when they go to the airport. One of the girls, the friends of mine who did get out of Gaza and into Egypt, she went to the embassy and she was asking someone, she was speaking to someone at the embassy in Egypt, and they said, where are you from? And she said, Palestine. And they didn't even know the name. And they asked her if she meant Pakistan. And she nearly cried because she realized that she's nobody. She's not even recognized as a person because she doesn't come from any country. So how can she ever immigrate anywhere? How can anyone grant her residency in their country if she's nobody who doesn't come from anywhere? You know? That's the position that they're in. So they have no voice. That's why they need people like me and people like Ken O'Keefe and people like that young Harry Fear who was in there recently to be speaking out for these people and bringing this to the attention of the world, because this is a system of surplusing and warehousing human beings. If you look at the West Bank with all the checkpoints, 500 checkpoints in such a small area, and then you look at the dispossessing that's being done in Gaza and you put it together, here you have, this is the system of dispossession that's being globally accepted. And then you look at Australia, here's the way to disarm them. Here's the carbon tax. Here's the way to corral all of these people. So the world needs to pay attention to what's going on in these countries. And a lot of these things are tried out here. Australia is one of the most controlled places on earth. And still, we've got a lot of freedom because we've got a lot of space. You know, 22 million or 26 million people in an area bigger than Europe, you know, bigger than the United States. So we've got a lot of space. That's the one thing I noticed when I came back here. It was like, I arrived to Sydney, it looked like a ghost town to me. You know, Brisbane looked like a ghost town compared to somewhere like London or Madrid or, you know. But we've right. got that space here, so people don't notice how controlled they are, but we really are. And people need to pay attention to what's going on in these places, and they really, really do need to pay attention to what's going on in Gaza. So hopefully it'll be played the right way. Hopefully they'll use this opportunity to play it the right way. And it's great to see the combining of Fatah and Hamas, but you've just got to look at how it's being played, because I don't know whether I trust either of these organizations. They both got ties to Israel, so what's the agenda? And where do the people fit into it? That's my question, you know?
You know, Hitler didn't even go as far as to extradite people from their countries where they're from to come back to Germany to be exterminated. He didn't even go that far.
There's a lot of things people don't understand about World War II and don't understand about Hitler and don't understand about the whole Jewish question and the whole Jewish issue through World War II, what it was all about,
true.
What actually happened. I mean, there's a lot of supposition, there's a lot of speculation.
Speculation, yeah.
And there's a lot of propaganda about what happened in World War II. An interesting thing is the transfer agreement. The transfer agreement is a real smoking gun because, and you can actually still find, I think, if you search, if you do a headline, World Jewry Declares War on Germany, you should find a headline in a newspaper from about 1932. Because what happened was the German Chancellor, who was Adolf Hitler at the time, had started moving Jewish businesses out of Germany because they were crippling the German economy. And he realized that there was less than 1% of the population who were all happened to be Jewish. They all worked together and they all combined their businesses and they controlled all the media and the newspapers and everything. And he just thought, and they're milking the wealth of the country. And normal Germans were being impoverished, and so he closed down all these businesses. And so the Jews around the world who ran the economic system around the world all basically declared war on Germany in 1932. and they took steps to boycott German businesses and create, you know, change the flow of cash. And they succeeded in almost bankrupting the German economy by doing so after it had been built up to what it was, you know. And so Hitler signed an agreement with a group of Zionists called the Transfer Agreement. And what they did was they agreed to move, because they'd already set up a want for Israel in the Balfour Declaration. They'd set this up with England in 1917, but nothing had ever really come of it. You know, the Balfour Declaration was basically a result of World War One. And they're saying, you know, for your help in World War One, we'd kind of like you to do this for us. That's what the Balfour Declaration was all about. But nothing really eventuated from it. So in 1933, after this whole economic battle was going on between the financial Jews of the world and the German government, Hitler signed an agreement called the Transfer Agreement, which moved 63,000 German Jews, got them out of their places, packed them on trains, and sent them off to Palestine, where they infiltrated into Palestine and they set up the foundation for what would become Israel. And he also gave them $100 million. That was part of the agreement. I don't know whether it was dollars or marks. I'd have to look that one up. So there were 63,000 Jews moved into Palestine in 1933 and paid a $100,000 or marks, or $100 million or marks, in order to set up the foundation for what would become Israel in 1948. So you could say that Adolf Hitler was the financial father of modern-day Israel, and Israel would not exist were it not for the agreement made by Adolf Hitler in the Transfer Agreement. And, you know, what could have been there to set up Israel in the beginning anyway in 1948 when they declared it to be Israel? There had to be some infrastructure already there to do all this. It didn't just appear overnight. And of course it didn't, because there were 63,000 German Jews smuggled in there by the German government in 1933. So people really need to look at what the trains were for, where the Jews were taken, and how Israel really formed. And I urge everybody to look up a book called The Transfer Agreement by a man called Edwin Black, who is a Jewish scholar, by the way. This isn't some anti-Semite. This is a Jewish scholar who started looking into the history of his nation. So look up this book and see what the story actually is, and you'll find the documentation to verify everything that he says in the book all still exists. So I think there's a big misconception going on about a lot of the stuff that happened in World War II. Now, we have to remember that history is written by the winners, and Israel and Zionism basically controls the world media, so I think we really need to pay attention to that, too.
In the few segments that we have left, I would like to cover some of the Hollywood aspects of the recent events. We know that in The Dark Knight, there's a lot of connections between The Dark Knight Rises and that shooting and the Newtown shooting. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they put this stuff in there. I think they put it in there intentionally for the conspiracy theorists, you know. Keeps people running down little rabbit holes looking for all these connections rather than stepping back and looking at the big picture and actually seeing what's going on and how to deal with it. They're all running down trying to find out the next, oh, look, there's a clue, here's a clue. It's like the old Beatles albums when, you know, Paul's dead. Everyone started buying Beatle albums to find all the clues. It's kind of like that, you know. They put them all there for you. Of course they do. But even finding that, what does it do? How does it help things? How does it improve things? You know, there's a bigger agenda here going on that's happening because people aren't in their heart space, you know. So all of it is a distraction from ourselves and a distraction from the solutions, I think. It's interesting that it's there, and it's interesting that they would put it there. But, you know, there's a bigger agenda. All the world is a stage. And they want you going down looking at that rather than building ties in your community and standing up and doing public speaking and all of this sort of stuff. Rather than finding yourself and finding your heart, they'd much prefer you to be going and looking for clues in Batman movies. You know what I mean? So
true.
It's interesting. And, of course, you're going to find it. It's always been there. All through this whole charade, there's been all these little clues put everywhere. And there's the old ritual thing as well. They have to tell you what's going on. Yeah, we told you. See? Sandy Hook, first strike, says there in the movie. You just weren't paying attention.
I'm more into the Hunter S. Thompson viewpoint of journalism, which is saying and doing the craziest thing imaginable and integrating every aspect of my life into my work. We'll be right back with Max Egan, TruthFrequencyRadio.com, and TheCrowHouse.com.
All right, final segment, and we are going to bring on Steve of Forbidden America here in a few minutes, probably in about 15 or 20 minutes, just to tell us a little bit about Forbidden America. And I hope you guys stay tuned in for that, because it's going to be a great show. As always, he's been a broadcaster for quite some time and is taking that step up, and he's got some information to share with you as well. But we're speaking with Max Egan and also Zen Shaman from the chat room, and I'm really glad to connect with Zen Shaman. I've talked to him in the chat room many, many times before, but I've never had a chance to speak to you voice to voice, so it's definitely a pleasure. Anything you want to add for Max, or any more questions?
No, I just wanted to touch on his time in Gaza. That was a very pivotal film, I thought, that he did there, and I just wanted to touch on that real quick. Thank you, guys. Chris, it was a pleasure talking to you and Sheree, and Max, bless you, brother, and I'm following your work, and I hope a lot of other people do, too.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words, brother. Pleasure to connect with you.
Definitely. I think that was a fantastic segment. I'm glad he took the broadcast in that direction. And, Max, I've got to say, the cojones on you, man, for doing what you did is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I would have a hard time removing the fear if I was in a situation like that. So maybe you can share with the audience how you were able to take hold of your own emotions as you were in this very life and death threatening situation.
Well, I didn't really see it as life and death threatening. I mean, admittedly, when we were crawling into the tunnel, I mean, I got down the bottom of this incline, and I kind of looked at it, and it was only waist high. And I wondered if I was crawling into my own grave. I thought that. I thought, oh, I wonder if I'm crawling into my own grave. But I just did it anyway. But there wasn't any fear. I just thought, if I am, well, this is interesting. What an interesting way to go, you know. I didn't have any fear the whole time. Even when we were leaving Gaza, we got detained by Hamas on the way out, and we got driven through Rafah. They were trying to get us to show us where the tunnel was that we came in, the rebel tunnel. Because we snuck in, we got in there without permission, which is kind of interesting. You know, you sneak into a place like Gaza and you don't tell anyone that you're there. It's kind of dangerous in Rafah, because Rafah's right on the Egyptian border, and it's kind of a dangerous place to be. We went from there and we got to Gaza City. That was the kind of precarious part, going across the Sinai, because that's pretty open to ambush, and then going through the tunnel, then getting from Rafah to Gaza City. But it was kind of really hairy when I look back and think, wow, that was probably a really silly thing to do and a very, very dangerous thing to do. At the time, I didn't have any fear at all. I just thought, no, this is all good. This is just the way it is. This is just what I'm doing. So I just did it. And I didn't really have to think about it. I just kind of did it. But even, like I said, when we left, we got detained for, you know, quite a few hours on the way out by Hamas. They wanted to know where the tunnel was. And they drove us into the center of town. And when we're in Rafah there in the center of town, there was a really surreal moment when we're stuck in this intersection, and there was all these school kids, like swarms of school kids crossing the road, and there was a truck full of Hamas military parked on the corner, and then another truck pulled up, and all of these guys jumped out, and they had the black turbans on. This was Islamic Jihad. And a bunch of these guys jumped out, and they all had Kalashnikovs, and they're jumping around and yelling out Allah Akbar, and it was a full-on scene. And I could have put my arm out the window and put my around the waist of this one Islamic jihadist. He was right next to me, and he even looked down, and he noticed me in the car, and he looked and he saw Ken O'Keefe next to me, and then he looked in the front seat, and there's the head of Hamas border security in the front seat. I'm there in the back of this Humvee, and he kind of looked at me and nodded, and then just was back into it. And I thought, well, you know, any other time, you know, that probably could have gone really badly. And being this close to this man, the safest place I could possibly be would be in a Humvee with the head of Hamas border security, which is exactly where I was. So I just kind of pictured myself being up in the sky, looking down at the scene, you know, with all of this going on and these two white guys in the car. And I just thought, what a fantastic photo shoot. You know, what a fantastic photo op this would be. I'm thinking, I've got a camera in my pocket, but I don't know how happy this guy is going to be if I pull my camera out and take a picture of him, you know. So I didn't do it. But that was a really interesting moment as well, you know. There was a lot of it that was really, really interesting. You know, I found the whole trip there to be interesting. I didn't have any fear the whole time that I was there. So I don't think it's a matter of having big kahunas. I think It's just a matter of doing what's necessary. And I was there to go into Gaza, and so that's the way I did it, you know. Synchronicity brought me there, and if I wasn't supposed to be there, I wouldn't be there doing that. So whatever the outcome would be, so be it. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. And whatever it is, it will make a difference, you know.
Let me ask you this. Being there in that situation, would you say that these are really true Islamic jihadists in the sense that the Western media paints them out to be, that they do this because of Allah and they want to kill all infidels, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it a matter of survival and rebellion against the controlling system? And do you think if Israel wasn't pushing their hands so hard on them that there would be a country of Islamic jihadists?
Look, what I saw, I mean, I don't know, Islamic Jihad, the actual Islamic jihadists in Palestine are an offshoot of the Egyptian or the Islamic Brotherhood, which are all, they're all Egyptians. What I saw, they're just people trying to whip up the frenzy, whip up the problem, keep the problem going, perpetuate the conflict, make sure the border stays closed. You know, I can't see any of this type of activity performing any good. I can't even see it as a response to the atrocities that have been carried out against the Palestinian people, because most of the Islamic jihadists aren't Palestinian. They're from Egypt. You know, they're from the Islamic Brotherhood. They've been chased out of Egypt and chased out of other countries. They do recruit young kids as martyrs, and they recruit young kids to their cause. They make it seem attractive to be a martyr, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But I think all of this is controlled opposition. I think it's all controlled response. I think it's designed to perpetuate the conflict. I really do. I don't think it's got anything to do with the actual people of Palestine. And, I mean, Hamas tolerate them being there because, I mean, I don't know why, what the relationship is with Hamas. So I probably shouldn't even speculate. But the fact that they are in there is a lot of the reason why Gaza is locked down, the fact that Hamas tolerates Islamic jihadists in there. That's one of the main things that people hear. Well, if Hamas isn't a terrorist government, why do they allow this group, which are known as they're on the terrorist list, they're known as a terrorist organization? Yeah, but you got to look at it. Look who's calling them a terrorist organization, the United Nations. I mean, look what the United States, I mean, look what these countries have done. Look what these people have done to the world. The United States hasn't exactly been friendly to all the countries it's gone into. If you go into Iraq and ask an Iraqi, they'll tell you the United States is a country of terrorists. Look what they did to our country. So it's all a matter of perspective. You know what I mean? So, I mean,
The reason I ask is I'm trying to paint a picture in my mind of America's future if we were in a situation where there was heavy militia presence fighting off UN troops or even American military, would we be in the same type of situation? And if so, how would the public look at us? I mean, of course, the mainstream media would paint any kind of militia action as terrorists.
They already are.
Right, right, right. But I'm just wondering if the same would apply there, where these people are actually rebels, and they're painted as these extremists. But from what it sounds like, from what I gather, they may even be controlled by Israel and implanted there in order to keep this agenda moving forward.
Well, they may well have been. That's the thing. I mean, they're not anything to do with Hamas. They're not anything to do with the people of Palestine. The Islamic jihadists, I mean, like I said, they're the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, they're just an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're mainly Egyptians. And so you've got to wonder about the whole thing, you know. What benefits? Who benefits by them being there? And they don't seem, you know, particularly stable, what I saw. I mean, they're not the sort of guys you'd want to be hanging around with, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, the role they're playing, I don't really know. I mean, it's just such a complicated issue. But I know that they're in the country, and it was just interesting seeing them on the way out. It was like seeing the other side, you know. When I was in Gaza, I saw a really good side of the Palestinian people. But seeing that on the way out in Rafah there, right next to the border, there's these guys really trying to whip up the crowd. And really, it was a crowd of afternoon shoppers and school children. And I couldn't figure out why they were there. I almost felt like they were there for our benefit. You know what I mean? It almost felt like they were putting on a show for us or something, you know? Just because they were there, I couldn't see any real reason for it, you know, in the crowd that they were whipping up. It was just a strange event, you know?
What's the relation, if you know, between Hezbollah and Hamas?
Well, look, I don't know. Hezbollah are a different country. I mean, but if you look at Hezbollah, you see what the people say about Hezbollah. They say they're great. They're the resistance. They're who's helping us. You know, so you look at what Hezbollah's done for the country. They've done a lot of good things for Lebanon. So right. It's Lebanon, isn't it? Hezbollah, yeah. So, I mean, it's the same sort of thing, you know, really. And Hamas, I mean, Hamas have done a lot of good things for Gaza. They've really kept the place going. Without Hamas, it would have gone already. It would be, you know, the people there would be dispossessed already. But, I mean, there's a lot of people in Gaza say, well, we wouldn't be under siege if it wasn't for Hamas. So it's a delicate issue. But, you know, but what you would be is you'd be in a situation like the West Bank where you had checkpoints everywhere. I mean, that's the thing. When Hamas took over, or when the, I mean, and they say that, you know, Hamas seized power in Gaza. It didn't happen like that at all. Hamas were voted in. Fatah wouldn't give up power, and so Hamas had to take it. You know, they had to basically take it. Hamas, it's like someone voting Barack Obama in and George Bush refusing to leave. And so Barack has to take the presidency by force, you know, because Bush was trying to retain it by force. That's kind of what happened with the whole Hamas seizing by force concept. They didn't. You know, they were just they were forced to. But they're
legit. Well, they're moving here. They're moving here in the United States to get rid of the two-term limit on the presidents.
Right.
Do you think that will happen? And if so, will we get stuck with a dictator like Obama, or maybe even the next person that comes in office?
Well, yeah, it could easily be. I mean, it could easily be. They've been pushing towards that for a long time. I mean, you can see this has been happening for a long time. They've been suggesting this sort of stuff. They plant the seeds way, way back, you know, and they've been, you know, pushing for this. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Well, and I mean, this is the first time in human history that we are so asleep as a society that we don't know automatically who Caligula is, or I mean, some girls that I grew up with, they wouldn't even know who Stalin was. I mean, they just weren't taught that. And so we have a huge population of people that technologically they can survive in a social environment, but when it comes to actual historical fact, they're retarded.
Well, yeah, it's designed that way. You know, he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. It's the way it works. That's a George Orwell quote, you know. So he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And that's the way they do it, and that's why they do it. See, people aren't taught how to think. They're taught what to think. That's what it's all about. People know what they're taught to know. They don't really know things in their heart anymore, and they don't know history at all. And if you don't know your history, then you're going to repeat it. But again, even history, you've got to look at that objectively. You've got to go and research it for yourself. Go around the world and check it out, because what you find if you just read books is that history is written by the winners. And the story that the winners tell is not always exactly what happened. It's always made to make the winners look like they were the good guys. But not always, this wasn't always true, you know. Such wasn't always the case. Look at any historical event and you'll see it as it's a completely different when told from the other. When told from the other side. There's actually a story, there's an interesting documentary that's been on YouTube. It's about 17 or 18 parts, which shows World War II from the German perspective, which is very interesting. It's called, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And it's a real eye-opener to see what the situation actually was around that area and, the things that Hitler did for the country and the war from a German perspective and what happened in Germany. And what happened to the German people, the atrocities that were carried out against the German people with the carpet bombing of London, I mean the carpet bombing of Germany, and the rapes, the thousands and thousands of women who were tortured and raped, some 100 soldiers a day for days on end, raped to death. Some of the stuff that they did when the Russians took over Berlin, and some of the things that were done in Croatia and Poland that sparked the war, were absolutely horrific, and people need to look at these things from both sides. Every conflict, they need to look at it from both sides, and don't just believe the history that the winners tell you to believe. You've got to understand that there's atrocities and problems on both sides of all of these conflicts. And, you know, the powers that be at the moment have lied to us about everything. Do you know anything they haven't lied to us about? So what makes anybody think that they're telling the truth about what actually happened in World War II? That's something that you might need to think about. It's a very, very delicate point, because the whole Holocaust thing, and Hitler's been painted as the big demon, and all this sort of stuff, and I'm not saying I support Hitler, I don't support any political figures, but I think that people need to look at both sides of the story and see what actually happened before they go and make judgments. The same as what I said earlier about Sandy Hook. You really need to step back and look at the bigger picture.
Even mainstream Holocaust researchers are saying, well, it wasn't actually 6 million. It was more closer to 1 million. What we've been told is actually not accurate. So it's even becoming the norm, the mainstream, to realize that we've been lied to about Nazi Germany. And you're absolutely right. I think the history is written by the victors. And in this case, we were the victors, at least on the surface. And so we've written history the way that we wanted it.
Yeah, exactly. And I suggest that people really look into what happened in World War II. I reckon they should look into the transfer agreement and think about the significance of these 63,000 Jews being put on trains and smuggled out. I mean, you know, we've all heard about the Jews being put on trains. You know, they come and hoarded them out, put them on trains, took them away. They went to the death camps, but we can't find any evidence in any of the death camps that any of them were killed. You know, it's just the evidence isn't there to support the notion of the Holocaust. It just isn't there. You know, the camps are there, but the evidence that should exist in the camps still is simply not there.
Right.
And we know with the transfer agreement that there were 63,000 people. That's a lot of people who were just taken out, put on trains and sent away. But they were sent to Palestine, and it happened in 1933, not during World War II. So, I mean, sure, Hitler didn't like the Jews. He did a lot of bad things to Jewish people, and there probably was acts of violence that were carried out against these people. But I don't think that it happened the way we were told. And I don't think Hitler, you know, Hitler's invasion of Poland is what sparked World War II. Because Hitler basically went into Poland to free the Germans who were being brutalized inside the Polish borders. Because after World War I, there was the Treaty of Versailles. And a lot of German land went into Croatian hands and into Polish hands. And there was a certain time in the late 1930s when the Polish government had basically had enough of the ethnic Jews and it removed all their rights, and there was a massive ethnic cleansing that started happening in Poland, and tens of thousands of German Jews, or Polish Germans, were brutalized and raped and killed and burnt and beaten. And Hitler was seeing all of these people. He never agreed with Versailles. He never agreed with the loss of land and all the German people that suddenly became Polish who didn't want to be, and we're all inside Poland's borders, and now all these people are being killed. He thought, no, I've got to go and save the people. I've got to go and save these German people who are being killed. So he went into Poland to rescue all the German people who were being brutalized. Once he'd taken over the government and deposed the government that existed, he gave Poland back to the people. He didn't want it. He just wanted to free the Germans. So, right. You know, you've really got to look at, you know, as soon as he invaded Poland, England declared war and all this sort of stuff. So it turned into World War II, and he tried to petition for peace for a long time. He never ever wanted to fight the British because he considered the Germans to be very closely related to the British, and he respected the British ways, and he didn't ever want to fight the British. So there's a whole different side to World War II that we're not being told about, and I think all leaders are a bit strange anyway. So I'm not supporting either side in it, but I just don't think it all happened the way we were told.
Definitely. Max, we really appreciate your time this evening. I'm going to let you go just a few minutes early so we can bring Steve from Forbidden America on, and he can tell us a little bit about his show. But is there anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
No, just know yourselves, folks. The same message that I'm always giving people. Yeah, know who you are. Look at things objectively. Always step back and look at the bigger picture in all of these situations. Don't take anybody's word for anything. Don't take my word for anything I tell you. Go and research it for yourself. And find out the truth for yourself, because really it's all about finding yourself. That's what you're here to do. Find yourself and experience yourself. So, yeah, good luck. I just hope the show's helped people. And thanks for listening.
I think it does, definitely. And you've been a big inspiration to us and many out there as well. I mean, you just heard from Zen Shaman, for instance. Mm-hmm. So many, many thanks for all your hard work. And when do your podcast come out? And I think you do a radio show as well.
Yeah, I do a radio show every Friday. It's like 9 o'clock central on the American Voice Radio. Then I record it onto YouTube and upload a YouTube clip and upload it to the Crow House. So you can probably get them every Saturday morning. If you can't listen to the show, check the crowhouse.com radio archives every Saturday morning and you'll find a new show in there every week.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, my friend.
My pleasure.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Mr. Max Egan, thecrowhouse.com is the website, and we're